This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott, and this is where government actions meet business decisions, online at bgov.com and on the air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30. On the program today, that is, lots and lots and lots to talk about as we discuss Israeli technology, which could be in the spotlight should they choose to attack Iranian nuclear sites. What? That's right. Ambassador to the U.S. Michael Oren told BGov on August 15th that it's possible. It could happen. So Dr. Kevin Brancato will be here with the details of what they could be using and where they got it. He'll also be joined by defense analyst Christine Ryan to talk about the quickly depleting arsenal of Harrier jets. The production line is closed and parts are few and far between. So what are the Marines going to be using next if the F-35 continues on the delayed path it's on? They'll be here in a little while to discuss. Are you on a medication that's been difficult to get the past couple of years? Well, don't worry, you're not alone. I'm in that boat too. Number of drugs the FDA considers to be in short supply has grown exponentially, and Medicare price controls may be the culprit. Healthcare analyst Brian Rye will be here to explain. But we'll kick off the program with a man who we often turn to with our sequestration updates and questions. He's defense analyst Rob Levinson. Hey, Rob, how are you?
I'm great, Alan. Thanks.
Good, good, good. So back in September, the continuing resolution was passed. What did that get us? Anything?
Well, basically, Alan, the continuing resolution, which has become sort of the norm in recent years, means that the Congress couldn't pass a budget. Mm-hmm. So they basically said, okay, everybody in the government continue to spend at basically the 2012 levels of spending, and they added about 0.6% to that number and just said, keep spending at that rate, don't start any new programs,
right,
and go on at that level until we figure this thing out.
This is not necessarily a good solution, if you ask me. I'm playing devil's advocate here. The continue spending at 2012 levels and adding a percentage or two or three or six, however many percentage that was, is going to put us behind the power curve once a decision is made with regard to sequestration. Is that correct?
Right. One of the interesting things is the levels that they set for the continuing resolution, particularly on the defense side, mm-hmm, is actually, if it was annualized for the whole year, in other words, it's only a six-month CR, but if they spend at that level for the whole year, it puts them above the cap that was set in the Budget Control Act. And so basically what that means, if they spend at that level through the whole year, in addition to sequestration, they get another $10 billion knocked off because that level is way too high and is not in compliance with the Budget Control Act, and it sets up some real problems for them.
Okay, so help me understand this. I've been reading the news a lot lately, and back in, I guess it was July, Raytheon set their earnings per share up about 15 cents per share, a little bit more, saying, hey, it's been a great year. It's going to be great. CEO of Lockheed Martin came out and said, we're not going to issue any termination notices with sequestration coming. Is there a sense of complacency with regard to contractors at this point regarding this cut that is coming? I mean, the clock's ticking.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd characterize it as complacency. Thus far, though, you know, DOD officials are telling the Department of Defense to continue spending as normal. They're saying, look, we're not anticipating sequestration. We don't want you to anticipate it and hold back any spending or anything like that. And, you know, we still think Congress is going to fix this. I'm not as optimistic. And I think the companies really are starting to think hard about what they might do. And particularly we think, and some have told us, that they're holding back on the hiring, at least. They're not hiring new people. So their projections are still fairly optimistic, but I think they are having to consider what might happen in January.
Your latest insight is called What Congress Giveth, Sequestration Taketh Away. I love the title, number one. number two, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. I think the spigot's been opened a little bit too far with regard to the continuing resolution. And I think that we're going to end up way behind the power curve, having to cut far deeper. And kind of piggybacking on what I just asked you about the defense contractors and complacency, it almost appears as though, to me, they're saying to themselves, oh, well, you know, the subs are going to take the cut. Anybody else but us, we're going to be fine. Everything is off the shelf because we're Teflon at this point.
Well, I suppose, you know, I mean, how each company deals with it, if their contract gets cut, you know, they can hit some of their subcontractors and try and push off a lot of the pain onto their subcontractors. That's certainly a possibility, but I think that's contract by contract. There's still going to be some pain. I don't imagine how they can really avoid it.
For the most part, when I talk sequestration, I think about the defense world. What does this mean to the non-defense world?
Well, it doesn't mean a whole lot different to the non-defense world. Of course, the cuts are spread out. It's about $38 billion on the non-defense discretionary side. There's some mandatory spending that's cut as well in Medicare and things like that. But it goes out to the contractors on the non-defense side. And the estimate right now that came out in the OMB report, I believe, is around just over 8% will be cut on the non-defense side. So contractors for those companies will that support those various agencies like Health and Human Services or Department of the Interior, they're going to get hit as well.
As I often do around this time, towards the end of the interview, what's next? You know, where are we now? It's kind of a holding pattern with the election right around the corner. What are the next steps?
Right. I mean, I think really nothing is going to happen until after the elections. Everybody has to see, you know, who's going to be in the White House and what the composition is of Congress. And I think that there is definitely a will to sort of undo sequestration. Now, whether that will happen in the lame duck Congress, which is after the election but before the inauguration in January, or maybe even after the inauguration, because they can certainly retroactively do something. I mean, yes, sequestration takes effect on January 2nd, but nothing really has to happen right away. So they could do something retroactively. But there does seem to be a will to fix it. It's just a question of how the politics all sort themselves out.
You will come back to keep us updated, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Very good. His name is Rob Levinson. He's a defense analyst with Bloomberg Government. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. As we turn to the world of aviation, so to speak, defense analyst Dr. Kevin Brancato and federal business analyst Christine Ryan join us, federal business intelligence analyst. Excuse me. Christine, how are you? Thanks for being here. And you too, Kevin, although you're here a lot.
Got it.
So thanks for joining me. You guys have done a lot of research lately on the plight of the AV-8B, also known as the Harrier. Overseas in Afghanistan, there was a battle not too long ago, September 15th, and unfortunately we lost two Marines in that battle. At the same time, we lost eight Harriers. And there's a problem with the number of Harriers. The number of Harriers is quickly depleting. How are they maintaining these things, Christine?
So there was an attack on September 14th, and they are currently using a number of different defense contractors to maintain the Harriers. Yeah. So Northrop Grumman and BAE Systems are two big companies that do maintenance for the Harriers.
So back in May of 2011, we counted about 144 of them. So far at this particular base, they've lost 11 at my count. Three previously were sent over from another base, and then the eight now. Are there any plans at this point to shore up the fleet with more Harriers? Are there more model Harriers out there that they can bring in, or where are these parts coming from? How are they maintaining them? That's my question, ultimately.
So the last new batch of Harriers was actually purchased in 1992. Mm-hmm. They went out of production in the late 1990s. There have been programs to modify and enhance the Harriers through the 1990s to add radar capabilities and to add nighttime capabilities to them as well. But until the F-35B comes out in full production, the Marine Corps is essentially in modification and maintenance mode with the Harriers.
Modification and maintenance mode. That means we're finding spare parts wherever we can, Kevin?
So the Marine Corps bought the remainder of the British Harriers, the Harriers that they essentially couldn't afford and made budget cuts in 2011. And so the Marine Corps decided to shore up its parts supply by buying 72 of the 74 Harriers that the British government had left in what is essentially the pristine condition.
Wow. Would one of those Harriers happen to be the one that landed on the cargo ship? Just curious.
I don't know. So folks can do a Google search and find an interesting video of one of the Harriers, which does vertical takeoff and landing. Yeah. And to find that it had, on an emergency, landed on a cargo ship.
Yeah. And fortunately, the person from the Royal Navy, I guess it was, didn't face any charges. He only had like a minute's worth of fuel, according to him, left. So the Joint Strike Fighter, delayed. We don't know when these things are going to be coming back into action. The Marines depend on these planes for ground support, correct?
The Marines, this is their this is their baby. They don't want to rely on right. the Air Force to come in and support them. They want to have their own aviation assets. And I think as you noted before, 144 of these are remaining. They expect to lose about two every year, and they've lost quite a bit.
Right.
And they need to have these for a pretty long time until the replacement comes in. The Marines say they're going to be able to do it. I think Christine and I have been pretty skeptical about that.
Well, they are Marines, so they're gonna find a way. Let's put it that way. We're gonna shift gears. May seem a little awkward of a segue, but you wrote another insight entitled "Attack on Iran Would Showcase Israeli Technology," and there's kind of a connection between the Harrier and the Israeli plane. What is that connection?
So the AVAB, one of the upgrades that is recently been completed, and there might be some more coming on, is this lightning pod, which essentially does weapons targeting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is built by Northrop Grumman in the U.S. for the AV-8B, but it was originally developed by an Israeli company, Rafael. And so that's really that one segue, is that right. Israeli technology, advanced technology for weapons, is in U.S. aircraft, but it's also in, of course, in Israeli modifications to U.S. aircraft. So Israel has bought F-15s and F-16s from the United States.
Right.
The F-15s are by Boeing once, McDonnell Douglas,
sure.
And F-16s are Lockheed, used to be General Dynamics. And they don't just buy them in stock configuration. They want them to be able to operate with their own missiles, their own equipment. And so Israeli aerospace industries, Elbit, Rafael,
right.
Other smaller players, will add their own electronics, and it's these that will be used by Israel, these aircraft, as part of their way to, if they have to go in
sure.
and try to take out Iranian capabilities.
Kind of a sensitive topic, because the Western world, meaning people like Raytheon, Boeing, those companies very well could benefit from something like this.
Yeah, what we're really trying to show is that it's not that there is an intent to start a war in
sure.
order to profit,
sure.
but that the reality of the situation is that equipment which is proven in battle has a much greater chance of being sold. And so these upgrades that Israeli companies have can potentially pave the way for future sales. Specifically, as we mentioned before, the F-35 has been delayed considerably. This is the upgrade for the next generation of fighter aircraft across the globe. There are essentially 11 countries, including Israel,
right.
that want to buy the F-35 and put Israel
their
wants to put its own equipment on there.
Sure.
But there have been considerable delays. And so countries across the globe have F-15s and F-16s and might seek to modify them using equipment from Israel or from Raytheon or other U.S.-based companies. And in this considerable competition for radar upgrades, a demonstrated capability in war could go pretty far.
Well, demonstrated capability in anything is always a benefit when considering a purchase, and obviously it's one that they have considered. F-35 still delayed, impacting two countries now that we've just mentioned in the past couple of minutes. I wanted to go back to the Harrier for just 1 minute, because obviously war is nothing that we want to promote, want to benefit. And I want to just take a moment to pay tribute to Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Rabel, aged 40, and Sergeant Bradley Atwell, 27. Both of them were the two Marines killed in that battle at the bastion overseas in Afghanistan. So, you know, we were talking about this earlier today, and I know that they're replacing a couple of the Harriers right now, and you had heard a story, Kevin, about their names potentially being
yeah.
on them.
So I in our piece, we actually linked to it on BGov.
Mm-hmm.
There is a photograph of one of the replacement Harriers, and it has the names of the two soldiers who
right.
fell defending their unit in Camp Ashton. And we don't know exactly how much is going to be replaced, when, what, and how.
Yeah.
That's the sort of information that's not really really released.
Sure.
But in terms of the aviation capability, it just goes to show you how important it is that it would send it immediately.
This is true. This is true. Dr. Kevin Brancato, Christine Ryan, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
This is BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And have you ever had an issue where you can't get medications? I don't mean like not being able to get to the pharmacy, but like you go to the pharmacy and they say, ooh, my bad, we don't have this here today. Sorry. Or even worse, and probably more likely the case, you're in the hospital. You're waiting for a medication of some sort, something that needs to be infused, something that you need to take orally potentially, but something that's going to require a medical professional to administer, and it's not there. And you're stuck in the hospital longer because it's not there. Well, it happens more often than not, and it's been increasing over the past 5 years. To explain, we're joined by healthcare analyst Brian Rye. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Brian, I'm considering you the harvester of sorrow today because you're bringing me some pretty disturbing news about medicine and prescriptions and such. To start off, let's talk about the Food and Drug Administration. How are they defining these drug shortages, so to speak?
Well, the FDA considers a drug to be in short supply if the anticipated, you know, amount that all manufacturers can provide is not enough to meet what the FDA projects to be the demand. And as you mentioned, the problem is that the number of drugs meeting that definition has increased fivefold right. in the last 5 years, from about 50 in 2006 to just over 250 in 2011. And so it's become a really serious problem.
So after reading this study, your study, by the way, is called Medicare Price Controls Worsen Drug Shortages, Boost Gray Market. After reading this, I almost feel as though the drug companies failed economics because it's definitely supply versus demand. Is that what we're talking about here, or is this more of the Medicare Modernization Act?
Well, it's some of it. And I'm not so sure it's the drug companies who have failed supply and demand. Maybe some of our friends in Congress have failed that. But what's happened is...
Oh, that's it. Point the finger at Congress.
What's happened is, you know, when the drug goes generic, there's the floodgates open. A lot of suppliers come in. Prices can fall by as much as 90%. Well, when that happens, some of those suppliers sort of fall by the wayside and you're left with one, two, maybe three manufacturers of these key drugs. And as you mentioned earlier, most of these drugs, they're not pills. They're what we call sterile injectables that need to be administered in a physician setting, maybe chemotherapy and anesthetic, those types of things.
Sure.
Well, if you only have a handful of drug companies making these drugs, if something does go wrong and supply has to be halted, well, there's no one else to really step up. Where the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, which was implemented in 2005, just before this surge in shortages happened, what that does is effectively it put a price cap on these drugs. And so, you know, typically if there's a shortage, whether it's bread, milk, whatever, prices rise to attract more suppliers into the market. Congress effectively limited the ability of that to happen, you know, with these older generic drugs. And so, you know, other companies look at that and say, well, I'd rather make these higher margin drugs instead of this, and the shortage doesn't get addressed.
How long does the patent last on a new medication, let's say, before the generic market can really jump in?
So new drugs typically have about 17 years of patent life, but, you know, some of those patents are filed before the drug is approved. And so effectively, you know, it may only be a few years.
May only be a couple of years. Drug shortages, this is nothing really new. This has been going on for quite some time. What do we attribute the past performance to today?
Well, I guess there's a couple of different things driving what's happening now. We just talked about some of the economic changes.
Sure.
What's also happened is the FDA has become a bit more vigilant in inspecting these facilities. In 2007, 2008, unfortunately, there was a problem with a contaminated supply of heparin, a blood thinner, that led to about 80 deaths here in the United States. As you can imagine, the response of the nation's sole regulator of drugs was to become a bit more vigilant. And the number of manufacturing warning letters that the FDA's drug division issued doubled from 30 in 2008 to 60 in 2010, just 2 years later. Now, that doesn't explain all of it, but it has been a contributing factor because the FDA would say, well, look, we're not telling these companies to halt the entire supply. But from a company standpoint, faced with possible sanctions from the FDA, it's the most conservative and most prudent thing for them to do.
So let's talk about, we've talked about the drug companies, this gray market where people, explain the gray market. What is this? Where is it coming from?
So the gray market.
Is there a phone number?
1-800, no.
Yeah, okay.
What typically happens in a pharmaceutical supply chain is the manufacturer will sell it to a wholesaler who then sells it to a pharmacist, a pharmacy somewhere that will then distribute it to a provider or to a patient directly. In some cases, the pharmacy decide, well, I'll just sell it back to another distributor.
Okay.
Often, and this is where the gray market comes into play. Sort of think about scalping, if you will, scalping tickets. You know, where since Congress has sort of capped the ability of these prices to rise in an authorized channel, you have an unauthorized secondary market that pops up, and these providers who are desperate to get their hands on these chemotherapy drugs or anesthetics that are needed you know, to perform many life-saving techniques are willing to pay a lot more. And so there was an example where a drug, a chemotherapy drug that's been around for decades, was in short supply, costing about $7 a dose for the manufacturer to sell, went through over the course of a week about six different distributors just selling to one another before a hospital wound up paying $600 for that same thing. So a markup in total of about 8,000% for that one drug.
And in the meantime, and I want to touch on this, this doesn't just impact the drug companies, the person who's sitting there in the hospital waiting, but insurance companies are paying the price for this as well.
Well, some of them are. Obviously, Medicare, you know, caps what they're willing to reimburse. Hospitals, you know, have to eat the cost from a Medicare perspective, but they are able to shift somewhat. Maybe they can negotiate higher rates with private insurers that you and I may deal with and get higher reimbursement for them to offset the fact that they're having to pay these higher prices as a result of the shortage.
Maybe not listed as a drug price, but more for applesauce in the breakfast that you got that day.
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah. It's entirely possible, I'm guessing. So is there any end in sight?
There are some things they can do. Unfortunately, most of the steps that have been taken thus far appear to address sort of the symptoms or things on a company-specific level rather than the nationwide shortage. So President Obama signed an executive order last October, but it was really toothless. I mean, it effectively told the FDA to do things that it was already doing, you know, just work harder to prevent these from happening.
Right.
The FDA, in recent legislation that was passed, whose primary goal was to authorize the user fees for another 5 years, contained some provisions on drug shortages that, you know, allowed the FDA to sort of prioritize some inspections. It also allowed them or instructed companies to give the FDA a heads up if they were expecting a shortage. Well, that could work, but that could also give a signal to providers or gray market participants that here's something you might want to hoard in advance of that. You know, one other possibility that could maybe cause a problem is that the new generic user fees are going to provide the FDA with $1.5 billion over the next 5 years. That's a good thing in that it's going to speed up the review process for new generic drugs, but it's also going to give the FDA more money to go inspect facilities overseas. And a lot of the active ingredients in these drugs are made outside the United States. And so the fear is that, and I think a very real possibility is that the inspections overseas could find new reasons to halt production. And so while the drug in the United, or the company in the United States making the final form of the drug may be fine and in compliance, if it can't get the ingredient, we still have a shortage.
Good point. A never-ending cycle that it sounds like won't be resolved until well after an election, I'm sure. So, Brian, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. This has been Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I want to thank Rob Levinson, Christine Ryan, and, of course, Dr. Kevin Brancato for joining me. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the two Marines, Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Rabel and Sergeant Bradley Atwell, who paid the ultimate price in Afghanistan on September 14th. Hey, don't forget to watch Bloomberg Government's TV show, Capital Gains. It's hosted by Peter Cook, who will be joining me here next week. That's right. It's on TV, WUSA, Channel 9, every Sunday right after Face the Nation. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott or Bloomberg Government, that is at Bloomberg Gov. We'll get together again next Thursday at 11 a.m. to learn more about the business impact of government actions.
Longevity's Breathe Deep DC is an annual 5K walk to fight lung cancer, the nation's number one cancer killer. Longevity Foundation is funding life-saving lung cancer research and providing information and support to those affected. Gather family and friends and join Breathe Deep DC Sunday, November 4th at 9 a.m. at the Washington Monument. There is hope for earlier detection and better treatments for lung cancer. To participate, visit longevity.org/DC.